stay tuned for The Lynn Show. For the last 5 or 6 weeks, I have been playing interviews that I did with the graduating class of the FSU Oslo Conservatory for Actor Training program. Today, I'm airing an interview I did a while back with the director of that program, who's also the associate director of the Oslo Repertory Theater, Greg Lemming. An extremely thoughtful and philosophical discussion about what it means to be an actor and what it takes to train actors. This is a very unusual and stimulating discussion, or at least it was for me, and I hope it will be for you. So hang on, here come the show. The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about self-discovery, all about recognizing that while it may be an unpleasant truth, reality, it is what I believe to be the truth and reality, and that is that most of us come into adulthood in denial for aspects of ourselves. Even more than that we are in denial for aspects of ourselves, that is that there are things about us that we don't know, that we learned to put what I call undercover very, very early in our lives. And in a desperate attempt not to be something or someone that would not go down well in our family of origin or would not work with our teacher or our siblings or our grandma or whoever it was that was the major influence on us, we carefully, painstakingly, and very early first pretend not to be those things and then get so good at the pretense that we forget. The other thing about this is that we are virtually unaware of the fact that these things that we have hidden from ourselves, these lessons that we learned in early childhood about what it was to, what was all right to be and what was not all right to be. And also the larger lessons that we learn in our early childhood about what people are, what relationships are, how we're to be treated, what certain behaviors mean in other people. These learnings, they drive our behavior. I wanted to say they influence, but it's much, much stronger than they influence. They actually dictate our behavior. So if we were chastised for an outburst of anger or joy or, well, pretty much anything, sadness, fear, if we were sufficiently chastised, and then that chastisement can come in anything from, you know, the rolling of the eyes, the ignoring, the big boys don't do that, and good girls don't say that, to out-and-out abuse. So if we were encouraged, well, maybe it's discouraged, right, from this behavior, we become someone who not only doesn't do that behavior, but finds that behavior ugly, sometimes abhorrent, dreadful, contemptuous in others. If you heard that little jingling, that was my dog who came in to visit briefly, shook his collar and left. So we are then really unable to correctly assess a person who demonstrates this behavior which we have come to believe is ugly. There are two ways in which this can get in our way. The most powerful, because it's true for the most of us, is that this behavior, in this case I'm talking about, you know, an explosion of rage or joy or sadness or whatever, right, becomes unavailable to us. So that if we should experience terrific joy, terrific sadness, terrific rage, we may not be able to express it. And a couple of things are wrong with this. To begin with, unexpressed feelings stay inside of us and they don't do us any good. And then also, perhaps more subtly, but nonetheless powerfully, if we can't express that we're angry, or we're joyful, or we're sad, or we're scared, then other people react inappropriately to us. They can't see us for who we really are. Our relationships are tremendously affected by those things which we are unable to express, those things within ourselves. Now, this is the theme of the Lynn Show. This is the point of the Lynn Show, to encourage you if you're listening. Well, I suppose it's hard to encourage you if you're not listening, but to encourage you to wonder, are there things about yourself that you have been hiding? And can you see the way in which these things alter, affect your life? So, that's the theme, the point of the Lynn Show. That's the reason I do this show, to make the point that I believe all of us have come out of our childhoods with aspects of ourselves for which we are in complete denial, that there are things that we think, ways that we would act, people that we would be, except that we decided that was inappropriate or dangerous or would cause us some kind of pain or harm. And so we hid those parts of ourselves even from ourselves. And then, even the things that we know about ourselves, are we aware of the way in which it limits what we can do, limits the kinds of relationships we can have, limits what we can feel? So, that's what I hope this show is doing, bringing up this question so you can look at it. And another way in which I like to try and demonstrate this is in the interview series that I do called Anatomy of an Artist. And in this series, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. I do that because in order to make a living or even just to commit your life, because a lot of people who commit their lives to an art don't make a living at it, to an art. Some grammar teacher would tell me that was a mess. But in order to do this in any way in our culture, it has to be who you really are, because we make it so difficult for artists, any kind of artist in this culture. And in order to continue to do it, it has to be your real self. And when you hear these interviews, you hear what we psychotherapists call congruence. That is, what you hear is what you get, is that the person is in sync with themselves. This is actually who they are. And over again, you hear people say, when I say, you know, is there anything you'd like to say about giving your life to this art? They quite often say, well, I couldn't do anything else. So you hear the what it sounds like when a person is who they are. And it's my hope that when you hear this, any part of you for which you have been in denial will start jumping up and down and saying, yes, 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 I'm in here. See me, know me, be me, let me out. And that if that happens, that you will listen to some of the other shows in which I talk about how we come to put things undercover, why it's important to surface them, how you can do that, and what are the obstacles to that, because it isn't as simple as recognizing it and saying, oh yeah, right, I've been hiding that, let's let it out. It's a much more complicated thing. So now I'm going to play an interview from my series, Anatomy of an Artist. And this interview is actually the culmination of 8 interviews. I interviewed 6 of the graduating students from the FSU Oslo Conservatory for Actor Training Program at the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida. And over the last 6 or 8 weeks, with the exception of not last week, but July 5th, when I played Norman Corwin's We Hold These Truths. But aside from that, I've been playing all of those interviews with the graduating students, and I preceded it with an interview I did with Andre Malayev-Babel a while back, who is their first year acting teacher and who many of them talk about in their interviews. And now I am culminating with an interview I did also a while back with Greg Lemming, who's the director of the training program and the assistant director of the Oslo Repertory Theater. And this is really a fitting ending to this series, because I asked Greg, as I ask everyone, how he got involved in this art. For Greg, the art of theater, and we talk a lot about that, his coming to be who he is. But he also talks at length and so compellingly about what it means to be training actors, how hard that is, what the training requires. And I know that for me, and you'll hear it in the interview, a lot of the things he said I had never heard before. I think lots of us, me included, tend to think of acting as more spontaneous and natural than it turns out it is. The training is rigorous. If you were listening to what the students said about their training, you know that. And here we hear it from the perspective of the teacher. It's a very, very thought-provoking and interesting interview. And so I'm going to stop talking now and let Greg speak. And the other thing I wanted to say is that towards the end of the interview, Greg talks about this very thing that I've been talking about, the impact of what you learned in your childhood and how that affects your ability to see what a playwright has written and to do a role in the way that the playwright meant it, without laying on top of it what you come into adulthood with. It's, as I said, very, very interesting, very compelling. And so now I will stop talking. Here is my interview with Greg Lemming. I am here with Greg Lemming, who is the creative director?
The
director
of the FSU Oslo Conservatory for Actor Training and the associate director of Oslo Repertory Theatre.
What's the difference?
Oslo Rep has an artistic director under whom I work, and I assist him and work with him on putting together the seasons. Here, I am the director of the Graduate Actor Training Program that is a part of Florida State University and came down here 30 years ago to partner with the Oslo Repertory Theater.
Wow. It's an interesting organizational
chart. Very complex chart, yes.
So here, in the training arm, mm-hmm. you're the director.
Yes.
It's yours.
Yes.
You're not second to anybody here.
I'm the director of the graduate training program, yes.
Okay. And then there's the repertory company.
Right.
That uses your students.
Yes.
And in that setting, you assist the director.
I'm the associate director.
I don't know Greg at all. We have never met. Mm-hmm. I don't know anything about him. But I know that he makes his living at his art, because you couldn't possibly have this job and not do it, right? That has to be it. So what I am mostly interested in is how you came to do what you're doing.
Well,
let me just stop you for a second before you launch.
Sure.
And I mean, no, I want to hear whatever it is you have to say, but it occurred to me that was a little bit ambiguous. Not necessarily how you came to do what you're doing today, but how you came to do this with your life.
Oh, sure.
Okay?
Sure.
Good.
Well, I like everybody involved in the theater, I started out wanting to be an actor, but I was 6'6" and...
Yeah, you are, my God. He stood up and I'm 5 feet. I think I'm still 5 feet. So, I mean, oh, my God. Is it that there are just not that many roles for people who are...
You know, I had a boyish face when I was a young kid.
Do.
Well, even more boyish 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And you don't have that many roles for young men who are 6'6". The last show I was cast in professionally was a production of Our Town, and I was playing George next to a 5'2" Emily. It was really dopey. So I figured that was the point that I decided to find another connection to the theater, and I studied directing. When I got out of graduate school as a director, I worked in New York for a couple of years with a number of organizations, and then was hired as the dramaturg at Hartford Stage Company. So really my professional career has been in the regional theater. I've always worked in regional theater. I've been associate director of theaters. I've been artistic director of theaters. I've bounced around mostly New England. So coming down here was interesting to me because I got to align myself with the Oslo Rep, which is one of the major regional theaters in the country. But the other reason I'm here is because while my passion is working in the theater and directing and producing theater for communities, I've also started in the past 10 years to get very interested in training artists and working with artists to create the foundation for allowing them to have lucrative and long-lasting careers. So I jumped at the chance to combine both impulses. So running a graduate training program was, along with being able to direct and work with producing at the Oslo Rep, was a great thrill, so it was a nice combination.
Yeah, it's the best of all possible worlds.
Yeah, it
worlds,
is.
Right?
It is. I get to be a generalist instead of a specialist, and I like that. I do a lot.
Well, you get to do both, actually.
I do a lot of things instead of only one thing, which I like.
Actually, that's an interesting statement. A lot of people who fall in love with an art wind up doing a lot of things.
Well, sometimes you have to do it to keep your head above water. I mean,
yeah,
it's really
survive.
About keeping body and soul together. I know almost no one who works in the theater who doesn't have to support themselves with some sort of secondary job like teaching. I was very lucky. For 30 years, I never had to. That's really surprising. I mean, I'm one of those very few people who managed to have a career for a long time and still have managed to hold on to a career in the theater without having to support it with something else. It's not an easy thing to have.
Not needing a day gig.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Or having to, you know, get out of one big hit show and then turn around and temp for the next 6 months or that sort of stuff,
right.
Or teach on the side. It's just, yeah.
So How did you fall in love with acting in the first place?
Well, I'm not an actor. I'm a
in the beginning, when you wanted to be an actor, do you remember that at all?
I know that I got interested in it because I think everybody who goes into theater feels looks at that as a place where they can actually feel comfortable being center stage. It's an ego issue. It has to do with wanting to express yourself, sort of show yourself off and show yourself off emotionally to the world in a place that's safe for doing that. Like everyone else who I knew when I was in the theater, when I became interested in the theater in high school, I was always such an odd, geeky kid that it was always a great place for me to feel at home. I think that's how a lot of people get involved.
I'm sure you're right. Yeah. Where did you grow up?
Oh, Long Island. Yeah, in fact, when everybody else was stealing their family cars to go out to parties, I was stealing the car to go to New York to see plays. Yeah, so we would sneak
in. Were you literally?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I would steal, we would say, oh, I'm just going to a friend's house around the corner. Mom, I'll be back at 11 o'clock, and we'd drive into the city and see a play and come home.
Really?
Yeah, sure.
What an anomaly. Did your family know about your interest in theater? Or?
They did. They weren't crazy about it because they didn't see it as a career.
So they were not.
Well, they didn't hold me back.
No, I don't mean that. I mean they weren't in it.
No, not at all. In fact, what's interesting is there's only one other member of my family who's in the theater, a cousin who is, ironically, coming to the Oslo this year to perform in the Oslo's production. He lives in Chicago. He's been in Chicago for years doing theater there. And he's going to be acting in the Oslo's production of Wonderful Life.
Oh.
So that's great. I'm looking forward to that.
A family reunion.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly what it is. It's very exciting.
Do you have siblings?
I do. Uh-huh. Sister, older sister, an older brother, and a younger brother.
Oh, right in the middle. And none of them had any interest
in... Well, my older brother toyed with it. He never committed to it. It was always just a hobby to him. High school and college. And then he got out of college and said, I'm going to be an actor, and stayed home and smoked a lot of dope for a year until he chose to go into the Air Force. That was...
So not at all like the theater. It's structured and it's stable.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't have to think.
Yeah.
The complete opposite of the life in the theater.
Sure,
my God.
Sure.
Okay, so this is really interesting. You come from this family that is not interested in the arts.
Uh-huh.
And so where do you think it came from? What do you think triggered it, turned it on? Do you remember the first time you thought, acting,
I do remember the first production I saw that made me want to go into it. It was a television production. In fact, I worked with Sam Waterston once when I was at Hartford Stage, and I mentioned to him at a rehearsal that I felt like he was the one that made me want to go into the theater because he was in a production of Much Ado About Nothing that was at the Public Theater in New York in the early 70s. Sam Waterston and, I'm going to forget her name. Oh, my God. I had the two of them paired up forever. But it was in this production, Much Ado About Nothing, at the Public, and it was televised in the mid to late 70s. And I just fell in love with this production so much, it was on a couple of times that one weekend. I remember watching it over and over again. And
what play was it?
It was Much Ado About Nothing,
right.
Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing.
So you already were familiar with Shakespeare, though. I mean, this was not this is an unusual thing for a boy in high school to find attractive.
Well, I was a reader, and... Mm-hmm. I do remember that I used to read, this is so geeky, but I used to read Hamlet a lot because it was a great murder mystery to me.
Yeah.
I always felt it was a great, wonderful murder mystery.
Well,
my God, did he or did he not do it? That was the great thing about that play to me. And so I used to read that. I remember reading, I said at my uncle's house I must have been 11, 12 or something. And I was down in their den while the family was having dinner, and he had a copy of Death of a Salesman on the end table, and I picked it up and read that for the next 2 hours. For some reason, I liked reading plays.
It is unusual, though.
You
haven't ever thought about that, but...
I just liked reading.
Yeah.
I just loved reading.
Right. You like fiction. You like stories.
A lot of fiction.
Really.
Yeah, exactly.
That's it.
Yeah,
you like stories. I understand.
Yeah.
I understand that very well.
Sure.
And, of course, if you like stories, there's writing and acting, essentially.
Yeah. Well, I think... I'm not sure I was ever much of an actor, but I know I always liked being involved with telling stories. That thrilled me. Especially telling stories and structuring stories and watching people respond to the stories and not having to be a part of that. I like having that, being in that position as a director, sort of being the editor with a group of actors and sitting down and deciding to tell a story and finding out the tone of the story and the structure of the story. And
it's fun. It's interesting to me that this is something of a dichotomy, it seems to me. On the one hand, when you first started talking about it, you said that actors are people, and I pretty much assume you were talking about yourself as well, who are looking for a place to express themselves and to allow their emotions to have reign. And
I got over that.
Yes, that's what it sounds like.
You're right.
It sounds like you got over that.
I did.
Yeah, right. And so now, instead of that, you are more interested in creating an environment for other people to do that.
Well, I mean, I'm actually, that's what I love so much about what I do now. I get to do both. I get to create, I get to work as a director and do that with a group of people and tell stories with a group of people. And I get to work with young artists who are interested in exploring the same world and want to investigate the craft from the ground up. Those are two different impulses, and they're really, it's really thrilling to be on both sides of them.
Could you talk just a little bit more about them, the ways in which they're different, what it means to you?
Well, I think there's a point at which, I mean, I don't want to sound like the old man in the sea, but there's a point at which when you go back to doing something a lot, you start to do it, you develop muscle memory, you develop sort of an intellectual muscle memory, and you do things not by rote, but by sort of unconsciously.
Yes.
And for good or for bad, I mean, sometimes it's not a great thing, sometimes it's what has to happen. And the nice thing about working with young artists is that you actually have to stop and think, okay, what are the first principles that I'm taking care of unconsciously, that I'm not thinking about anymore? What are the first principles that get this process rolling?
You mean for yourself?
For myself or for anyone in the business and it working at it. And so we get to stop and explore those with young directors and young actors. And that's pretty exciting. That's great. I tried to teach. I taught high school for a while. I actually liked to teach.
Yeah.
But I taught high school for a while, and I hated that because I was just a traffic cop. And then I taught undergraduate for a while. And sometimes I loved that. But that's actually more about helping people develop psychologically. I think as an undergraduate, you're developing a personality more than you're developing a career.
It's an interesting point. I never heard anybody say that.
I think that's why liberal arts are
so important.
What they are is that it's about people developing a broad personality. And because you're really dealing with social issues and psychological issues and personal issues. And that's also not something I'm terribly interested in getting too deeply involved with. So the nice thing about working on a graduate level is you really focus in on the craft. You're still emotionally involved because as in this art form, you sort of have to be. You have to deal with the emotional level. So that's kind of great for me. It's worked out really well.
Yeah, it sounds actually like you've found the thing that works best for you.
So far, yeah. Absolutely.
Now, that's an interesting statement.
Oh.
Is that because you think, I'm always evolving and it could be something else some other time?
Well, you know the joke about the psychiatrist studying the pessimist and the optimist, the five-year-old child. The five-year-old pessimist is put in a room full of with horses and spends an hour sitting there sobbing until finally the therapist walks in and says, what's the matter? And the pessimist looks up and says, I knew you were going to take this away sooner or later. The optimist is sitting in a room just full of hay and horse dung and is spending an hour giggling and throwing it up in the air and running around and playing it. And the psychiatrist walks in and the optimist, the five-year-old boy looks and says, I know there's a pony in here somewhere. I'm the pessimist. Sooner or later they're going to take it away from me. So
I see.
Yeah.
I see. Wow.
You know, I'm the person who's going to die and have on his gravestone, I told you I was sick.
and you've always known that about you.
Oh, I don't know. I guess so. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it's also a matter of, I've only been here for 4 years. I still like doing it. I was working in the theater for 25 in regional theaters, just from one theater to the next. And when I sort of reached the point where I knew this is it, I've sort of reached the top that I'm going to, as far as I'm going to go, I needed to jump out of that. So who knows? I mean, I don't think I'm interested in sort of growing, I'm certainly not interested in growing in the university community here. I don't want to be a dean or I don't want to be, you know, not interested in that. I may get bored with what I do someday. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll just finally open that bookstore.
Did you? And, yeah. Do you direct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. I direct once a year on the Oslo stage, once a year on the conservatory stage with the graduate students, and then usually during the summer I try to do a show.
So what are you directing this year?
I'm in the middle of working on a production of Imaginary Invalid for the Oslo, mm-hmm. which we're having a lot of fun putting together, mm-hmm. which will be opening the Oslo rep season in January. And then with the students, I'm directing a musical, chamber musical called Three Postcards by Craig Lucas,
yes.
a man who did Light in the Piazza. And that'll be in April on the historic Oslo stage with the conservatory students. And then, who knows, I'll have somebody to hire me this summer. So it's usually two a year here and then hopefully one out of town.
Okay, so it sounds like you really have found a place that, at least for now, you can throw some straw around. And
yeah, I can. There are some things I'm really good at as a director. And
what are they?
Comedy. I'm very good at that. I'm very, very good with new plays, with contemporary work. And in some cases, I'm pretty good with Shakespeare and intellectual, sort of cerebral work like Shaw. But there are some things I'm just not good at that I will never grow into that are beyond me. So I'm better off in a place where I can pursue my strengths and explore other things like the administration of this program and the teaching on this program and working with the faculty and working with the students.
Did you ever think of writing?
I've actually done some. When I first got here, when Howard Millman was in his last year, mm-hmm. and he showed me the list of plays that he was doing, and we hadn't talked about which one he wanted me to direct yet, and he showed me the list and I saw a play on there that had been about 2 years before I got here, I was hired to do an adaptation and translation of a French farce in Dallas. And I had so much fun doing it. In the middle of that French farce, they refer to another French play, and Howard add on his list that French play. And so I jumped up and down and begged him to let me do that. So I've done two translations, adaptations. I've got some other work in a drawer. I've been working on an adaptation of a novel for years, and I got through Act 2 and I'm just hit a brick wall. Every time I go back through, the brick wall doesn't move, so someday I'll get around to finishing that. That's pretty much it.
Can you tell me the novel?
No. I mean, other people have adapted it. I think I found a way into it. I love the novel and someday I'll do it. Someday.
I understand that. Do you have anything to say to aspiring actors, to people who are thinking about this career?
Well,
career in the theater?
The cliche is, if you can do anything else with your life, do it. That's the cliche. I don't think I believe that now, actually. I mean, now that I think about it, I actually think that if you actually can commit yourself to this fully and commit your life to it, do it. But that's a big if,
yes.
Because it's not a guaranteed living. It can be a very frustrating lifestyle. You have to be very stable psychologically to do it as a freelancer. I never did it as a freelancer. I'm not stable enough. I was always with a regional theater, with an institution. But as an actor in particular, you know, you're constantly, every single time you end a job, you start from scratch.
Right.
You're always at the whim of somebody else's taste. And so it takes a lot to be able to say I commit to this completely, but I actually think it's a very full life. It's a very, you get to lead, it is really leading an extremely rich, thoughtful, and engaged life on all sorts of levels. I mean, I think it's pretty exciting.
It's funny, when I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, it is true. I think it's true, you know, I don't speak for truth, but I think it's true that as an actor, when you're working anyway, it's new, whatever it is, it's new, and it's challenging, and it's, assuming that you really do like what you're doing, that it's exciting, and in those ways, if that's something that turns you on, you know, okay. There are a lot of people who are not turned on by, you know, they want the same thing every day. They want to, you know, they want secure.
Sure.
And but if you're turned on by this, mm-hmm. then you get it in spades.
Oh, absolutely. And it's also very personal. I mean, it's a life led from a completely personal and self, not selfish, but from the self.
Mm-hmm.
You have to engage in everything you come across. You have to personally engage with everything
yes.
so often. I think it's a very vibrant way of living. Sometimes too vibrant, and it can really beat you down psychologically, and it can be tough. But it's a good way to lead a life.
Mm-hmm.
It's very exciting. I was just talking to one of our graduates on the phone this morning, graduated about 3 years ago, and we always had, he's one of our older students, and we had a very good time working together. And just in passing, we talked about trying to come up with a project to do this summer. And, you know, being able to make those kind of connections, to develop work with people you respond to and to explore material together from a very personal perspective, it's very exciting. Really
yeah, cool. And it's this making something out of nothing
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's something that turns you on, that doesn't turn everybody on.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's really kind of what you were saying, that if this engages you, attracts you, captures you, right?
Fully, right. If you're engaged by it fully, then it's what you should do. I think that's actually a better way to look at it than say if there's anything else you can do, do it.
Well, you know why people say that.
Well, because you can't make a living.
Because in our culture, that, you know, the idea of, you know, making a living is...
Well, and also art is frivolous in our culture. It's not something that you have to have.
I agree.
Yeah, and if you're an artist, you're pretty much outside the mainstream. You're not really... You are only respected if you have fame as an artist.
You're saying, I interviewed a musician yesterday, and you are saying what I said yesterday.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, it's so clearly the truth.
Yeah,
and
sure.
This is a relatively young guy. He's 32.
Huh.
And he is completely engaged in it,
mm-hmm.
and for its own sake, and understands perfectly well that he may never make a living.
Mm-hmm.
He'd like to be able to retire someday, you know, have money in the bank, but
mm-hmm.
But it doesn't matter because that's not what it's about, and that's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, I think as a musician, I wonder if you can say that. It seems to me that it's a little tiny bit different. I feel like when you're, I don't know, I'm way off base. It was always a choice when I was a kid. It was a choice between music and theater for me. And I've often been sorry I didn't continue with music because I was a French horn player. But there's something about creating music as a group or individually that is exciting to have an audience there, but it's not the purpose in an odd way. It's not as much the purpose. Musical performers may say the exact opposite to me, but it always seems to me that there's something about working as a group with other musicians to produce something for the sake of producing it is a little bit easier than working as an artist, an actor rather, on a...
Well, I think
electricity of the audience is essential to the actor. I guess maybe most musicians would say that electricity for the audience is essential for them, too.
No, I don't think that's true. I think you're right. I think, actually, a musician can get a kick out of playing in their own house by themselves.
Yeah,
I think that's really true. You know,
and I think there's value in the document. I mean, the recording that exists, you know, in the forest and when nobody's there to see it.
Right.
And that is always of value. The way a film is always of value. It exists. It's an artifact. But in live theater, there's no value if somebody's not there to watch it.
No,
it's not the same. It just doesn't exist.
The only caveat to that is actors often, when they're not working, spend a lot of time in class working on stuff.
Well, that's doing your etudes. That's doing your
right,
scales.
Right.
That's keeping your muscles.
Right, but alert. they can get a certain amount of pleasure from that.
Some, but it's a means to an end. It's not the end.
Yes, that's.
That's
right.
Not the end.
No, that's right.
Yeah,
that's
like
right.
You know, a flautist can do scales over and over again, but if you're not playing part of a concerto, then what's the point? It's not as interesting as the concerto.
Yeah, I saw a documentary once on, I do not remember her name, a female conductor, symphony conductor, and she was saying, you know, a musician can play in their house, an actor can actually work in, you know, can work, but a conductor needs an orchestra.
Yeah.
And sure. She, you know, that's
well, just, that's sort of just, the same thing with the director.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. A director
you
needs
can prepare
a
production all you want, but until you get in the room with the actors and the audience.
So, so you can speak to this, the difference between acting and directing and teaching for you.
I don't know. I think teaching, I'm beginning to realize, is Socratic, the right word. It's about making people come to realize, forcing people to come to discoveries about what they can and can't do.
As how do direct, you do that?
Well, I think one of our faculty members here is particularly good at it. I tend to talk too much in the classroom. But he doesn't answer questions. Somebody asks a question, he makes them do another exercise. Somebody asks a question, he makes them do another exercise. And it's frustrating to the students, but suddenly, I think by the end of the year, I think they suddenly realize, oh my God, I discovered this for myself.
You know, it's not only Socratic, but it's a little Zen, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. Mm-hmm. As a director, I think you are aware of the road you want to travel, and you're trying to engage everyone with you to travel that road together. You're not quite sure what the speed is. You want to make discoveries along the road. But you're also, you hopefully will be firing up the energies of everybody else in the room so that while they're getting on your road, they're also making discoveries and making little gems for themselves.
You know, I really think, this had not occurred to me before, but I don't think I've ever talked to anybody about this, that in the way you describe it, I don't think all teachers would have this one, but I think in the way you describe it, the one is about helping the other discover themselves, the teaching. But the directing is about telling them what to do, essentially.
Well, not really, though. That's what I'm trying to hedge. It's not. It's really not telling people what to do. If you're just telling them what to do, then the actors are just marionettes. It's about, as a director, you have to figure out what the path of the play is, but then invite other people on board to bring their portrait of the journey along with them. You can't tell them how to experience the journey. Their experience of the journey has to be as...
This is really interesting because I hear what you're saying, but in the end, you get to say, don't you?
Well, as a director, you're not an autocrat. You're an editor. You have to engage people's imagination, and then when they bring something in the room, you actually have to edit for them. I think directors are less of an artist than they are a technician. I really believe that. I think a director is really a technician. You learn how to read a play. You learn how to view other people's work and help them edit it. You learn how to sort of light the fire under people.
And then you stand back and let it flare.
Stand back and let it happen, and then you step in and edit a little bit more and edit a little bit more. That's what a real director does.
I believe you, but I would be willing to bet that not all directors have that perspective.
Maybe not. I don't know. It's possible. It's possible.
So in that way, teaching and directing is not that dissimilar.
You know, it's actually not. That's true. Although, as a teacher, you are very aware of the skills you want people to become aware of. You just can't
make them.
Make them. You have to. You can lead them to water.
Mm-hmm. Can you mention a skill?
Actually, one of the things that I'm doing, working on with the actors I work on every year is, one of the skills is being able to read a text objectively and to evaluate a script for what it is giving you, not for what you want it to give you. It's a really difficult challenge. A lot of actors and directors really have absolutely no idea how to read a play.
Can you say more about that?
Well, they will read a play lightly and then decide exactly what it's saying based upon their own perspective. They're really being very subjective. I had a student, this is sort of a perfect example, but 5 years ago I had a student when I was teaching undergraduates, and we were working on Glass Menagerie, in a directing class, and he just hated Amanda Wingfield. And I kept, what I kept saying to him was, does Tennessee Williams want you to hate Amanda Wingfield? Show me in the play. And we did this over and over again. So finally, finally in one session, he just burst out, yeah, she's just like my mother, and I hated my mother. And the thing is that what he's doing, what he's bringing to the work is a subjective response rather than reading the work to figure out exactly what the playwright is trying to get at. And that's a real difficult, that's a real challenge. I mean, it's very hard for, we teach literary criticism. We don't teach dramatic criticism.
This is fascinating.
It's a completely different technique.
It's fascinating because I imagine that it's very difficult to do what you're suggesting.
It is. It's very hard. And a lot of students get very frustrated with it and hate me for a couple of months. And then I think usually by the end of the year they sort of, they may not get it now, but I think in a couple of years down the line they often get it.
Well, the problem is that in order to do that, you have to have self-awareness.
Yeah, you have to be aware of how you're responding. You have to have a dual conscious.
You have to know yourself. Know thyself. Yeah,
You have to watch yourself respond to the play and then go back and figure out what in the play made you respond that way. And all that has to happen before you can even decide how you're going to interpret the play. And that's a big challenge.
That's a big challenge.
It's a big challenge.
That's really, and boy, I wouldn't have come up with that ever as a skill to teach an actor. I mean, I would just never have thought of that.
Yeah.
Do you want to give us another one? I mean, I thought you were going to talk about things like sense memory and...
Well, you know, that's you know, the other thing is an actor's imagination has to be vibrant and available, and you have to have a huge resource, well, of emotional and imaginative resources. But you also have to know how to... communicate that and bring that up and engage an audience in that. And that is a peculiarly theatrical sensibility. And figuring out what that element of theatricality is pretty tough. I remember the first school I was taught at full time, the other faculty hated anything that what they referred to as theatrical. They hated it. It wasn't real. Well, you know what? Standing on a stage with 500 people watching it was not real. It's not real.
Right.
And nobody thinks it's real. But there's that funny little, we have a compact. You know, I will never let down my guard and show you that this isn't me up on stage. And you will respond to it as if it's really happening. It's going to be safe for both of us, but we will allow the danger of the situation to exist and take us right to the edge. That's what the compact is in the theater.
Do you want to say that one more time?
Well, I mean, the actor is never going to let his guard down and let the audience believe that this is an actor acting.
Right.
The audience is going to always keep themselves open as much as possible to everything that's happening on stage.
Everybody is buying the...
You are buying it to a certain extent. You're always, however, aware of the fact that it is a performance.
Right.
It's what Aristotle said about Greek theater, is that, you know, what makes it theater is that element of an entire community getting together to watch a reenactment, not to watch the real thing.
Right.
There's nothing thrilling about watching a car wreck. There is something very thrilling about watching a reenactment of a car wreck. And because you're aware that not
being quite real. Right.
Might be very offensive to a lot of people, but I just went, you know, I was raised a Catholic, and I went back to a funeral not long ago, and it was a funeral mass. And I forgot how stylized and ritualized the whole mass is, and how, you know, so many Christian fundamentalists talk about it as fact, when actually it is a reenactment. It's a mythological event.
It's a performance.
Much more. It's much with a lot of poetic overtones. If it were real, it's not as interesting. Poetry has far more depth and scope than prose, and these are poetic events, and they can mean more if they're poetic. A metaphor has a lot more weight than a fact.
Wow.
It has a lot more. It covers a lot more ground.
Do you know why?
Do I know why? I guess because it's about a metaphor engages the human imagination.
Yeah, see, I think it speaks to the unconscious.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. It engages
right,
a lot more.
A much deeper level.
Yeah, a much deeper level, mm-hmm. Sure.
Right.
And that's what I think...
It bypasses the conscious mind.
Right, sure, sure.
Right.
And the theatrical process, I think, is all about that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right.
So getting an actor to be able to have that duality of depth and truth and honesty and pair it with the expression, the exhibitionist tendencies that all actors have to have. Being able to compare those two and balance them out is a real challenge.
It's a real challenge. Boy, I'm so glad to be having this conversation with you.
I
imagine that this is a kind of a mini course in what it means to be an actor, and I would guess that pretty much anybody who is not an actor doesn't know this stuff, doesn't know what it's taking to do that well.
Sure. I mean, I'm sure. There's nothing more annoying than walking, when you tell somebody working in the theater and somebody's been working in insurance for the past 65 years, says, I've always wanted to be an actor. Yeah, well, I've always wanted to be an insurance man, but nobody would hire me to do it because I don't have the skills.
Yeah, right.
I always wanted to be a doctor, but I'm not committing brain surgery.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a complete disconnect of what it takes to do that thing.
Sure.
And so I'm going to say again that I really appreciate. It's clear that you have thought this through, and whether you've thought this through or not, you're really articulate about it.
Tomorrow.
Yeah, right. No, but it's really articulate, and I really do think it's something I haven't come across.
Great.
I haven't. Nobody has said the kinds of things you're saying, and that's a value to me, and I imagine it's a value of the people who's value to the people who are listening.
Great.
So, is there anything that you think I haven't asked you? Or that you might like to say about anything?
I don't think so. No.
Good.
God knows I've talked enough.
Probably not, but I appreciate it. Thank you so much,
My
Greg.
My pleasure.
So, as I said, when you listen to Greg, you listen to a person who is very well grounded in who he is. What it is he can and can't do, what it is he's good at, what it is he wants to do, what it is that feels natural to him. And obviously, one of the things that feels natural to Greg Lemming is teaching acting, bringing that information and those skills that he knows so well to the people who want to do this with their life, to the people who want to give their life to the art of theater, of acting. And of course, he could hardly be in a better place to do that because that's where he is teaching these hungry people. And if you were listening to any of the earlier interviews I did with the students, you know that they come to this with a deep desire to learn what they don't know. Even as some of them have said, I think it was Angela who said that there were things that she didn't even know she didn't know, but got them anyway. And she got them because Greg Lemming runs this program. And so, as I said, I think this was a sort of mini course in what it means to be an actor. And I certainly enjoyed it terrifically, as you can certainly have heard. So, now let me say some things that I didn't say at the beginning of the show. You can hear this show as a podcast on my website, and also all of the other shows, all of the students and Andrei Malayev-Babel and every other show I have ever done is up there on my website, and my website is thelynnshow.com. It's one word, thelynnshow.com. Don't leave the E out of Lynn, because there's another The Lynn Show, and actually there's another The Lynn Show with the E, but not one word, thelynnshow.com. So, as I said, you can find the podcasts for all of my shows on the homepage. On the right-hand side of the homepage is a listing by category. If you clicked on Artistic Director, you would get Greg and all the other Artistic Directors. If you clicked on Actor, you would get those people. If you clicked on Musician. And then there are also categories of the concepts that I've discussed about how it is that we come into adulthood not knowing who we are. So the cover story and undercover, which I talked about earlier in the show, that shows up in a lot of shows, and if you click on that, you'll hear that. And also other concepts, and all of these concepts come from my book, which is called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do, and What to Do About It. You can find out about the book. You can download chapter one. You can find out about the workbook and the audiobook. Also, there's a song that opens and a song that closes my shows. They are written by me and sung by me, and there's a CD up there as well. You can find out about the CD. And if you are interested in psychotherapy and are interested in talking to me about that, there's an article called Psychotherapy on the Go about psychotherapy on the telephone. You can download that. And of course, as always, there's a spot that says email me, and you can email me with any questions, any comments. I'm always anxious to hear what you think of the show, of the website, of me, of anything. And while I'm talking about emailing me, I need to say, as I always do, that this show would not exist if not for the skills and talents of Josh Hackney, who makes this sound as well as it can sound given my limitations, and helps me with everything related to recording, computer, the show, pretty much anything technological. I go to Josh first. And if he doesn't know it, he knows how to find it. So if you've got any questions about any of this stuff, you also want Josh. And you can get him by emailing me on my website, thelinshow.com, and saying, I want Josh, and I will get him for you. So now, as always, I hope you heard something you could use in this show today. Something that you didn't know, something you knew but had forgotten, something that turned you on, inspired you, made you think about the part of you that you might be hiding, in denial for, not having access to. Anyway, something I hope that will bring you back, because, as always, I will be back, same time, same station, and, as always, I hope you will be, too.
See, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang, no, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang, rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't